Hi ladies, you're listening to the Goodness Podcast. My name is Noor Tahini. I'm the co-founder of Goodness and I'll be your host today. Goodness was launched in 2018 as a platform dedicated to tackling topics surrounding women's health in a real and honest way. And we're continuing on that mission with the launch of this podcast series, which will feature real women and real stories from the Middle East. My guest on the podcast today is Florence Gillet, an eating psychology coach based in Dubai. Florence grappled with orthorexia for over a decade, which affected her menstrual cycle and stopped her from conceiving. Today, she's sharing with us how she overcame her disordered eating and found body acceptance to turn her life around. This is Florence's story.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Florence. So you actually had an eating disorder, which is not often recognized as one, especially by people who suffer from it.
It is not actually recognized as an eating disorder right now. I would categorize it more as disordered eating, but I definitely identify with the term orthorexia. So that's what I was suffering from.
And so for our readers, what exactly is orthorexia?
Orthorexia is this obsession with eating healthy, pure foods, organic foods, which is a good thing to start with, right? When you start, you're like, I'm just going to make my body a temple and I'm going to put only nice things in there. But when it becomes really obsessive and it kind of stops you from living your life, stops you from being social, from going out, because you might not know what you're going to have to eat in different locations or at people's places or whatever, it becomes quite debilitating. And then the fear is really too strong for you to go and live your life to the fullest.
And so how did that start out for you, and when did it start out?
Well, I have a really long story. So it's funny because, you know, a lot of people say they started when they were teenagers and puberty, and it was such a weird phase. But for me, it started, I was actually 25. I was a young adult, and I think the main thing for me is that I moved away from my home country. I've been an expat since then, since 2005, so that will give away my old age. And, you know, I left my family, my support system. I obviously followed my fiancé at the time, which I'm still married to, so very happily. And we had no issues between us, but I think unconsciously, just being away from what I knew, having to build a completely new life, starting a new job, being in a much bigger city. I was moving from Brussels to London, which is like, you know, 10 times the size. I felt like I didn't know anything about anything. And then being alone. My husband at the time used to work 16 to 20 hours days.
Wow.
Yes.
Finance?
He's in finance. Okay. Yeah. So it was really the early years of finance. So obviously they worked them to the core. And, you know, I think I felt really conscious of also supporting him, because it was really hard on him morally and emotionally and physically. So I think I kept a lot of my own emotions hidden. And this is also something that I was taught from a very young age. I come from a family where we didn't speak a lot. I think it's very common for a lot of us. We've been brought up in this kind of culture of silence and saying, if you don't feel well, don't share it. Which is not always verbalized in that way, but you kind of understand it growing up. And for me also, I come from a difficult childhood. I had a lot of childhood trauma that I had not addressed at all. So when I came in this new city at 25, I decided, I'm on my own a lot. I don't really know how to occupy my time outside of work. I'm going to start running. And at the time, the UK had this campaign about you have to eat 5 or 10 fruit and veg a day.
Five a day, the servings, yeah.
Exactly. And I got kind of taken away by that. Plus, I was getting ready to get married. And so when I left Brussels, I had ordered my wedding dress. It's so silly if you think about it. I ordered my wedding dress and I had kind of 9 months until the wedding. And I felt really scared that I wouldn't fit into my dress for some reason, which was really silly, because why would I suddenly balloon? Like, it's just so weird. But, you know, all the narrative in the media as well. I was a big fan of women's media. I used to really read a lot of magazines, and I always, you know, did as a teenager as well. So I had this kind of constant narrative of thinner is always better. You know, if you're hungry, just try to drink a big glass of water or have like 3 almonds. And so at that time, I started counting my calories and running. And it quickly, obviously, got validated by other people around me who looked at me and said, oh my God, you know, you look so lean and you're losing weight. And I felt like what I was doing was the right thing, you know. I was definitely a perfectionist. And so I got on my way. And obviously, you know, I kept going for a long time because I was also taking birth control pills. So you just don't notice any changes in your hormones or whatever. So I only realized that I was doing all those things wrong, in between bracket, when I came off the pill in hope to conceive. And that was 4 years later. So at that time, obviously, I came off the pill and my period never came back. And I was like, oh my God, I'm already pregnant. Isn't it fantastic?
Were you living in Dubai at the time?
At the time, yes. I had moved to from London to Dubai. And I remember, you know, doing this whole routine where I would eat only clean stuff and, you know, count my calories and all, and thinking I'm going to be so healthy for this baby to come, right? And I had really no idea what I was doing to my body. You know, I was in my 20s, but as soon as I tried to conceive, obviously, and I came off birth control, I started seeing a lot of symptoms, like my hair fell out. I had terrible acne, like really it just kind of came like out of nowhere, which obviously was also masked by birth control. And, you know, I felt really horrible. I just felt like my energy was kind of off. I felt really tired, couldn't sleep because I wasn't eating properly. I think a lot of women who struggle with sleep issues, they kind of forget that maybe they're not fueling enough during the day. And so they wake up because they're hungry, or they don't eat enough carbs, for example. I felt like carbs was really a big dimension for me that I learned over time. So And then I was desperate to become a mom, and I felt really broken. You know, it felt really like my friends around me who had stopped birth control at the same time were already getting pregnant and having the baby, and I was still there trying to just get a period. And I have to say, doctors are not always cognizant of what it is for women to lose their period. It's actually called hypothalamic amenorrhea. It's quite a barbaric name. And so when they diagnose you, they can... For me, in my case, they diagnosed it, but they basically said, we don't know what to do to bring it back because you don't seem to be underweight. So for me, because I was not emaciated, I was not, you know, looking really scarily thin, they always felt like, yeah, you're a bit on a lean side, but I can't be that.
Did they base that on your BMI?
They obviously look at your BMI, mostly your weight and height. They don't really look much further than that. I think there's definitely more knowledge today because you have a lot of people trying to push for more knowledge also from women. And so they challenge their doctors. But you have to imagine amenorrhea is something that happens to about 5% of the population. So it's obviously not a case that they see a lot, you know?
Is it always linked to disordered eating or not having enough fat every time?
It's mostly being underfed and over-exercising.
Okay.
In some women, they do not exercise at all, but they're just underfed. In some women, they eat enough, you know, in between brackets, but they exercise a lot more. It depends. There's also an element of stress, for sure, that plays a role. And that's something that I love about eating psychology coaching. It could be also that in your mind, you're unable to give yourself the freedom, you know? So for me, getting out of amenorrhea meant actually having all the foods and getting over all the restrictions that I used to put in place for myself, thinking that's too many calories or that's not clean enough, you know? So the three things you need to think about is really how you eat, how much you eat, do you eat enough of everything? And that also includes what we see as non-clean food, you know, a kind of fun foods. But it's also about what sports you do, how often, and what is the kind of situation with stress. There's a lot of women struggling with anxiety. You know, it can come at a time that you're maybe studying and you're very stressed, or you're starting a new job and you're very stressed. And that's also why I talk about me leaving my hometown. And I think this was definitely a side of anxiety that I didn't really understand at the time, that I didn't consciously know about, but that was there for me.
Right, because the body doesn't differentiate between different types of stresses. So if you have emotional stress or you're going through a particularly stressful time at the office, and then you leave work and you go and you have this crazy intense workout or HIIT training on top of that, it's just added stress for your body that it can't differentiate between the different types.
Absolutely. And you know, you have to imagine also stress can be just a threat you have in your mind. So if you fear foods, this is also stress.
So just a perceived stress.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be real kind of threat, you know. This is not my information. Mm-hmm. This is actually the woman, thanks to the one I recovered that got me this information. Her name is Dr. Nicola Rinaldi. It's important for me to refer back to her. She is really the global expert on hypothalamic amenorrhea, and she does amazing work. She has over 95%
success rate.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Success rate. So it's, you know, and we see women, I'm partnering with her to support women on their recovery. We have Facebook groups. So if, you know, anybody listens to this and is a bit confused about what it means, definitely reach out. Her book is called No Period, Now What? And there's tons of information. It's really your kind of number one book for amenorrhea recovery, for also conceiving, because obviously a lot of women like me realize it when they try to conceive that they don't ovulate, they don't have a period, their hormones are too low to do anything.
Is the book available in the UAE?
Yeah, you can order it on Amazon or directly through the No Period Now What website. You can also reach out to me. I have a few books that I can sell to you if you're interested to have it quickly. So all this to say, Nicola Rinaldi, as someone who has a PhD, does a lot of research on obviously the everything that touches amenorrhea. Amenorrhea can actually also happen in a larger body. So it's not so much about you have to be underweight.
Okay.
It can happen if you quickly lost weight, for example. So basically, whenever your body feels like it's being starved, it could kind of stop having
it. So it's more about the behaviors.
It's more about the behaviors. If suddenly, you know, you were in a larger body, and it happens to a lot of women, they get told you have to lose weight for XYZ reasons, and they lose weight really quickly, and they go a bit overboard, you know, they really underfuel and overexercise and stop eating all the foods that they used to enjoy, and then they lose their periods, although they're not at a BMI that doctors would recognize as dangerous, you know? So for me, obviously, going back to my story, I finally found about this book. At the time, there was no book, but she had a blog. Dr. Nicola Rinaldi had a blog about this. I met her online. I started exchanging with other women on the online forum at the time. This is pre-Facebook.
Old school.
And I remember thinking, oh my God, what am I doing? Like, are these people really legit? Like, my doctor said to me, you have two choices. Either we put you back on birth control to protect your bones and everything. Either you want a baby and you do IVF. But here I am.
To interrupt you, the doctor never suggested eating more, exercising less. It was just,
No, and that's really the issue with a lot of doctors still. They just don't get enough information about this.
So basically through her blog and the forums, that's how you found out that the issue was actually with your exercising and eating. And how easy was it to make the shift? How easy was it to let go of that lifestyle?
It was so hard. It took me almost a year. So I lived a year in knowing that I didn't have a period. I was not able to conceive at this weight. And I most likely should put on weight and stop exercising. But I was in denial. I felt so strongly that I didn't want to let go of my ideal body, in between brackets. You know, the one I had worked so hard for and restricted so hard for, which is so silly if you think about it. But also because I live very much in the lean body, even when I eat all the foods and enjoy life, you know. But I had just internalized the idea that I need to always strive for thinner. And this is something that is very toxic to women today. We keep hearing this all over the place. And unfortunately, it really is a disservice to a lot of us. So whatever your body size, by the way. So, yeah, it took me a year and then I took a leap of faith. I was like, I'm going to follow this woman who I, you know, never met, who says something that my doctor doesn't really recognize, but it felt right. And obviously I could see other women on the forum going all in, which is the way we describe recovering, is going all in. You're going to eat all the food, stop exercising. It's a bit like poker, right? You just... give it your all. And then it went really quickly. I just needed less than 6 months to recover. It was, I did put on quite a bit of weight. I had to restore quite a bit of weight. I had to get my weight higher than it was when I started dieting in 2005. But on my second cycle, I conceived my son, who's today going to turn 9. Yeah. So it definitely works, and it was the hardest thing and the most beautiful thing. Like I shiver when I think about it. It's just, I couldn't believe that, you know, I had put in the work, and then when I saw that I was actually naturally pregnant, I even went back to my OBGYN and she was like, how is it even possible? I left you without a period and here you are pregnant.
2 cycles later.
Yeah. So it, you know, to me, it was life changing. And at the time it did cure my kind of anxiety around body and food because I was focused on maternity. The point was having the baby, you know, bringing this baby to the world, making sure he was healthy and happy and that I could breastfeed him as well. And everything went really, really well. I actually conceived a second child on the back of that. It was a bit faster than I thought. Because it took me a while to conceive, I really thought like, oh, it's going to take me a while. It's okay. I don't need any birth control. Well, no, turns out you are very fertile.
You hear that story so much. Yeah.
And so obviously when my youngest child turns 2, I go back to work full time. And I feel very anxious about leaving my babies and starting work. I want to go back to work, but it's also very stressful, a lot of organizational difficulties. And I decided at the time, because I was still suffering from acne, which is most likely from all the metabolism issues that I've had because of my own wrongdoing, I read about, you know, inflammatory foods and how this is really bad for your skin and dairy and gluten and take it out of your diet. And I go back and I go back. That's really when, for me, this is really my orthorexia started. I started eliminating whole food groups, which is crazy. You know, I was working a lot. I was caring for those 2 children. I was trying to exercise. I was not eating enough. And this is where, for me, the kind of border gets blurry between, was I really doing this just for health and my skin, or was I doing this to stay thin? Unofficially, I think in my mind, I didn't believe I wanted to be thinner, but I think definitely I was also looking for validation, like I had before.
Dr. Karine Elkhazen, who is the vice president of the Middle East Eating Disorder Association and a woman that we both know, says that eating disorders actually are tied to a genetic predisposition. You're not predisposed to the eating disorder per se, but you have certain traits and characteristics like perfectionism, which I think you mentioned at the beginning, and low self-esteem, etc., which... with the need to, or the will to be thinner and to diet, come together and create this issue.
Absolutely. And as I said, I come from a family where mental health diseases were actually quite rife. So it's, again, totally unbeknownst to me at the time, but now I can see how, you know, my dad was deeply in depression for most of my childhood. So definitely, you know, there was definitely a background for me in this. And, you know, all of these issues kind of made me reach out for control. So when you don't feel well, you kind of look for how can I control my emotions? You know, you have those big emotions and nobody tells you how to deal with them. You haven't seen that modeled in your family of origin. So, you know, my parents were definitely, I love them to bits and I don't blame them at all, but they were definitely struggling with dealing with their own emotions. So, and to me, food and being in a lean body and having this kind of perfect body from the outside was my way of kind of coping. It was really more a coping or a numbing mechanism. And I see that in a lot of women that I work with today, where they just use it as a coping mechanism rather than really using it for getting leaner or whatever. So I stayed in that phase for a good 2.5-3 years. And obviously, the more I was getting on with that, the more anxious I felt. Because you feel like if you fix your appearance, you're going to feel confident about yourself, but it's actually the opposite. You need to really kind of face your own fears, build up that self-confidence from inside, work on your mental health, to then, you know, feel better and get in a better place.
How much of that do you attribute to external messaging from our culture, the media, maybe the industries that we were working in at the time, which for both of us was fashion?
Yeah, definitely. It's a big part. There's a lot of research actually that shows internalizing the thin ideal or the perfect, you know, body and all of that is very, very strongly related to eating disorders as well. It's obviously, as we discussed before, a lot of different factors, but we do need to speak to younger women in a different way. We do need to also talk about body diversity. I mean, for me, like I didn't see body diversity. My social media feed was just Thinspo, Fitspo, which was these women with, like, you know, visible abs and super lean legs and toned arms. And I just felt like this is the goal, right? And if I don't conform to that, I'm not going to be respected or looked at in the right way. It all came to a head when I actually lost my job. In 2015, I learned that the company I was working for was about to close. It had nothing to do with me, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of anxiety already, and I felt like I was losing this way, that I had worked so hard to maintain this job. And I had a lot of issues also at home, you know, dealing with my children. Obviously, I was crazy irritable because I was not eating enough. Like, yeah. I was tired and cranky and hangry, you know.
Yeah.
So poor kids, like I used to just lash out, and, you know, these young children had no idea. And I still today pay the price for that. Like they really struggle also with emotions regulations today. So it's important that we deal with our own problems, right, when we are mothers.
Yeah. You have to model.
Absolutely.
And
I really don't say this. I really want to be really compassionate. Like, I don't say this in a way like, oh, you know, you can't do this. This is terrible. But we do have to be conscious of the way we deal with our own issues is exactly what is going to happen when our children grow up, you know. And then also my daughter made a comment. So she was 4 by then. One day we went to a fast food chain and, you know, I never restricted them, quite obviously. I think I knew that it was definitely wrong to do that. And we sat down, and I don't know why that day I ordered a meal and I sat down with them and I had the same food. And she said, oh, Mama, you're eating like us? And that was like a knife in my heart. I felt like this is wrong. What I'm doing is wrong. Plus, after my first pregnancy, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease, which is an autoimmune disease of the thyroid, your kind of chronically low thyroid, for which I get medication, but obviously it can affect your whole hormonal balance. And I was working really hard on my diet to recover naturally from Hashimoto's, which never happened for me. There was this narrative online that you could do that, but you had to be super restrictive, not having any of the, you know, whatever was processed was the devil. And unfortunately, on one of my endocrinologist check, he actually told me that it was getting worse and that I was becoming insulin resistant.
At that time, you had already begun restricting and cutting out food groups?
Yes. Okay. So this is about 2 years into restricting, you know, dairy, gluten, all of that stuff.
And you would have expected him to tell you the opposite?
Well, I think I would. I was not expecting anything, but I was expecting to see results from my healthy lifestyle regimen, which was really hard to maintain. Because obviously, any time you would go to a restaurant, for example, and you would see everybody ordering nice desserts, you feel like, I'm not going to have it because it's going to ruin all my efforts. But the reality is, this is what orthorexia is, right? You're kind of forbidding yourself to have even just a little piece of brownie or whatever, thinking it's going to just undo all the work that I've done. And this is when it becomes too obsessive and too extreme.
But this is, it's so, so unbelievably common these days. And it's associated with... It actually is associated with a higher moral value, I think. You look up to people who have that kind of control and knowledge around food. I've been there. I've sat in restaurants and asked about the source of the eggs and the chicken and is the fish farmed or not farmed. But I think it's about finding a balance, right? It's about having awareness about what you're putting in your body at the same time as not letting that negatively impact your life, the life of your children, and so on.
I think it's definitely balance that we need to strive for. And I think we need to be very critical of the messaging that we receive. That's something that I keep telling women. If, you know, eating super healthy works for you and makes you happy, you do you, right? Me, it made me really crazy. Like, it made me believe every time I was around foods I was not supposed to eat. Like, I would go really anxious. And then I would somehow have them at another time, you know? Because, and this is how sometimes binge eating starts, where you restrict so hard when you're in a social setting, but then when you're on your own and in secret, you will have all the foods that you don't allow yourself to have, which is totally counterproductive. But what I'm talking about in being critical, I agree with you with the moral value that is put on people having the willpower to resist all of those things. And, oh my God, you are so good. Nobody is good because they say no to donuts at the back of the office. You know, it just makes no sense. There's no moral virtue in eating less of one food or another food. This is diet culture. Diet culture puts thinness on a pedestal and tells you thinness is everything you need to get to. It's going to bring you success. It's going to bring you a moral value and virtue. It's going to open all the doors. It's going to make you healthy, happy, everything. But the reality is, it's not true.
But you touched on something very interesting that I want to go back to. Clean eating is very often associated with or leads to binge eating. And perhaps you would tell me, based on your experience, if orthorexia always leads to binge eating, or it depends on the person and the situation. But from the reading and the research that I've done, what ends up happening is the more you restrict a food group, the higher the chances of you binging on it. So you might be gluten-free during the week, or you might do it for 2 weeks, and then you go out on a Thursday night or you go on holiday and then you eat all the pizzas and you can't stop yourself and you've basically had enough gluten to make up for the 2-3 weeks that you didn't have it.
Yeah. So orthorexia is not directly related to binges, but definitely restriction. You're right. So we know that when people start binging or saying they have those episodes where they can't stop eating, sometimes they don't know that, you know, it's called binging. It's difficult to really define what a binge is. For example, even in amenorrhea recovery, we actually don't talk about binges because this is really refeeding yourself. If you have been restricted a long time, it's normal that you will eat a lot more, that your appetite will kind of go crazy for a little while and then stabilizes. But the main objective when that happens is actually to allowing and giving yourself permission to have all the foods. Now, I'm not saying if you have celiac disease, go and gorge on pizzas. Obviously, you need to be concerned about that. But what I'm saying is we have a lot of narrative around food intolerances that are, again, not really grounded in science. So when I was at the in my orthorexic phase, I went and had my IgG testing done, right, where I tested for all the food intolerances that I could have. You do a blood test and they come back and they tell you you don't digest this or that very well. You need to come off of it for 6 months to a year. I mean, this is for me, like I had like 35 different foods that were actually listed on there, which was crazy. It made me really crazy around food. It's like, this is harming my body. This is what makes my health so bad and all of that. But the reality is now that we look into it more, you can see that none of it is grounded in science. If anything, IgG is actually telling you what you tolerate better, not what you don't tolerate better. And I have good resources on that on my website if anybody's interested. So the point is, you know, sometimes we and we come at it with the best intentions. We really want to get healthier. We really want to feel better in our bodies. We really want to feel confident. And diet culture tells us that this go through dieting or removing those toxic foods and all of that. But what we forget is that there's a really powerful industry telling us those messages. There's billions of dollars globally to be made on weight loss or gluten-free alternatives or bariatric surgery or all of these different things. And I think we need to be conscious also that when we start dieting or restricting food, it doesn't come without harm. It's not completely harmless. We kind of go and say, oh, it can't be bad. I'm just going to cut sugar out of my diet. But actually, as you rightly said, like when we cut sugar, sugar is also energy that we require in the human body. It's not just toxicity. And, you know, sugar until in the 50s was actually advertised as something healthy. So you can see the constant trends around food as well that are really dictated by businesses. They're not dictated by people that have your health at heart. They're dictated by people trying to make money off of your insecurity.
Yeah, I mean, we grew up at a time when butter was demonized and we all had Flora margarine spread. And then now the narrative has shifted to say that that's the devil and organic grass-fed butter is the best thing that you
so
could...
So good for your
exactly,
heart.
Exactly, yeah. It's so good for you. And the same narrative is happening now around avocado oil. So avocado oil was a godsend and now it's the devil. And I don't have the answers. And I think most people also don't have the answers as to which one of these narratives is the right one and which one isn't. And it makes for a very confusing atmosphere around food, a lot of anxiety because you don't know if you're doing something that's good for you or bad for you. It was bad for you yesterday, today it's good for you. So I think it can be very difficult to navigate. And so it's very important, as you said, to question the messaging, to question the science, to question the research. And there's a very good book that I read, and I believe you've read it as well. It's called The Gluten Lie.
Amazing, yeah.
So The Gluten Lie was written by, if I'm not mistaken, he's not a nutritionist, he's a psychologist.
No, his
behavioralist.
Name is Alan Levinowitz,
yeah.
And he's actually a researcher on religious
issues. Oh, he's a theologist,
issues.
That's right, that's
yes.
Right. You're right. And basically, he was looking at how a diagnosis, if someone is told that they have a gluten intolerance, if someone is told that they have a certain form of cancer, how that belief can actually go and impact their physiology and develop the issue
religions.
That was not there in the beginning.
But what
correct?
He's making a parallel between the clean eating movement and religion and how when people get stuck on that, they become really religious about it. If you speak to vegans about, you know, leather, you'll see what happens, right? They're pretty vehement about it. My drug of choice at the time was paleo. And believe me, I was talking everybody to paleo. Paleo bad for you? I don't think so, but it's like everything. If you take it to an extreme and you actually forbid yourself to have anything that is not in the diet, you become really crazy around it. And unfortunately, we forget that our mental health is a big, big chunk of our health. Health is not just food and exercise, right? It actually counts for maybe 30% of your health. A lot of your health is out of your control. You know, you have your genetics and what your parents gave you. A lot of your health depends on your social status and where you live and what kind of healthcare you have access to and what kind of environment you live in. Is it really polluted or not? All of this we have limited impact on. And I think this is also something we need to really consider. We can't just imagine, okay, I'm going to fix my health and just like exercise more and eat less. I think this is a dangerous thing that we need to really pay attention to before we start removing all food groups, you know, never having carbs again. This is actually leading to a lot of different issues with health that can become chronic.
So just to go back to your personal story, we left off at you having basically, you had lost your job, you were in a state of heightened anxiety, and you had been cutting out food groups and clean eating for
two, 3 years.
And so after your child said to you, oh, mommy, you're eating like us, what is it that really... So once you were ready to get treatment, which I think is always so crucial, you have to get to a point where you're ready to be helped. Otherwise, all the help in the world is not going to make a difference. What is it that helped you get out of that?
So all of these little moments happened around the same time. I felt so overwhelmed and really kind of in my heart felt like something's got to give here because it's not working for me, right? And then I was very lucky, actually, found the podcast, somebody on the hypothalamic amenorrhea forum that I was still a part of, commented about this body positive podcast. And I had no idea what it was. And I listened to it. And this was a coach just like me today, like somebody coaching women on body image and eating challenges. And she had this podcast and I listened to the podcast and it was like my epiphany. I just really started listening to all the older episodes. I went nuts. This was, you know, 2016. And I just went on and on and on. And then from there, it was like I listened to everything. I read all the books. I couldn't stop. I felt like I kind of discovered a whole new world that I didn't know existed. And I'm glad that I'm actually seeing more and more women realizing that there is an alternative to dieting and managing your weight and all of that narrative. There is another way to be healthy where you don't have to worry about all of that. And you can really listen to your natural hunger and fullness cues. And your body will be where it needs to be. And this is where I literally started thinking, okay, I'm just going to stop all of what I'm doing. This is not working for me. And I started really letting go of the restrictions. And I felt like I am going to gain weight because obviously the weight that I am now is not natural because I'm not eating normally. And it will be fine. And I will figure out things as I go along. And I worked with that coach that had the podcast that I fell in love with. And she helped me a lot. And then I worked with different people. I went to see a therapist, which was massive for me, which just changed my life completely. I went on after that much later to CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, which helped me also with a lot of the chronic low self-esteem and the issues that I had around, you know, imposter syndrome and all that validation I was looking for from external sources, not from inside myself. And then I worked with a nutritionist also, which was great because even though I recovered in a way, you know, I gained the weight and I was eating more and I lifted all the restrictions, he made me notice that I was still not eating enough, you know, because it's easy to be stuck in this kind of in between where you feel like you might be recovered, but you still have a lot of unconscious ways of looking at your body and saying, no, I'm not completely hungry yet. And so I'm not going to eat until I feel really hungry. And so all these practitioners were really life-changing for me. I learned to have gratitude and I learned to meditate and to work on mindfulness and deal with my anxiety. Do not be mistaken. My anxiety is still there. I live with it. I don't think it's ever going to go away.
But you manage it.
But I have healthy ways to manage it.
To soothe yourself. Did you notice that when you started to eat in a way that was less restrictive, and maybe you were out with friends and you were eating gluten and dairy, and not in a way that lacked control, but rather with the freedom of being able to choose a dish that you really wanted and that you enjoyed. Did you get comments from people? Did people notice that change in you?
Yes, I did. But I was very open about it. I think by that time, if you count what I discussed about before, it had been 10 years I was in and out. So people used to know me as the lean, fit, the runner, you know, the one that always eats the right foods and all of that. So definitely it was a big part of my identity. But I kind of came out. I kind of said to people, hey, what I was doing was really disordered. It was not actually the right way to go about it. And I felt very sick, you know, in my mind. I was really obsessed with food and I couldn't stop, because that's the other part of restriction. A lot of people will tell you, I can't stop binge eating, and they don't know that it's really too rich restriction. There's also a lot of people that will tell you, I can't stop thinking about food. I think about food all the time. And a lot of the times it's because they don't allow themselves to eat enough food. So there's this kind of cave brain that comes out if you are underfed chronically. And it doesn't allow you to see properly what's going on. So it's very important. First step, and this is really something that I do with clients now, is that we make sure that you are fed properly. And this is what we discuss: 3 meals, 2 snacks, sometimes more if people have been really overly restrictive. Sometimes it's about telling them whatever feels right. If you're hungry, honor that hunger. This is necessary. This is what health looks like for you right now. It's not so much to avoid this, that, and the other. It's really to feed your body, to bring that energy to your body. So as soon as I started doing that, also my brain started feeling better, right? Because I started being a bit less anxious naturally. I started sleeping through the night. I mean, it was like unbelievable for me. And for me, yeah, low carb was terrible. It made me so jittery and irritable, and I didn't see the link at the time. Now I can see it. I need my carbs. It's just I can't function. So yeah,
I've been open on goodness about the fact that I've received treatment. I'm still receiving treatment for binge eating disorder. And if I can share one thing that was sort of a big realization for me, it's that at the beginning of treatment, or sort of from the beginning to halfway, I was very scared of reintroducing certain foods. So I had this fear around how eating certain things was not healthy for me. So eating chocolate, eating fries, eating bread, eating pizza, whatever it was. But as you said, I was looking at health in a very limited, in a very limiting way. So my understanding of health was simply the kind of foods that I was putting into my body, but I wasn't looking at health in a more holistic and 360 way, which is mental health, as well as what are you doing to your metabolism? What are you doing to your body when you're binging? What are you doing to your body if you've developed bulimia as a result of that? And I'm sure that a lot of women can relate with the feeling of thinking about food all the time, where you've eaten something, so you think about, you kind of run through everything you ate that day, and you say, okay, so is it okay for me to eat tomorrow? Can I restrict? Do I have to skip breakfast? Do I have to skip lunch? Do I have to skip dinner? And it's like this endless tab that's just running in your head, adding up all the macros and all the calories, and trying to sort of punish yourself or restrict yourself. And as you said, you need to look at mental health and a broader definition of health, not just have you eaten sugar today or not.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you opened up as well. I think the more we all open up about our own struggles, the better, because I think neither yourself or myself looked sick in between brackets.
Yeah.
You know, we looked like hyperfunctional women. Yet if we knew that we would have a big dinner for work, we might not eat during the day, which is so toxic.
Yeah.
So toxic. The other thing that I found in recovery that was really, really helpful, and that I operate from this stance today, is health at every size, which is this way of looking at nurturing health from a non-weight-centric point of view. So not so much looking at the number on the scale, but looking at how you feel, how you move, are you feeding yourself consistently, are you taking care of your mental health? All that actually brings you to better health without actually considering even your weight or your BMI. Mm-hmm. And this is at even larger weights.
Yeah.
And the other thing for me was feminism. I know this is maybe like a little bit of a taboo name here in the Middle East, but the reality is, you know, I had read a few of the feminist books about beauty, for example, and some of them talk about how our obsession with being thin is not so much about conforming, but it's also about keeping women busy doing something that is not important.
There's actually a quote that I read, and I'm not going to be able to remember it correctly, unfortunately, or even attribute it to someone, but it said that dieting is the greatest political sedative that has ever been served to women.
Exactly. So, and that's exactly what you said before. If you, your brain is constantly occupied with food and how your body looks and how it should look and how you should exercise in an hour or two, or how tomorrow you're going to plan this and that, you're not doing bigger things, you know? And I'm so glad that I'm out of this, and that whatever now I spend the time on, it actually is to make a difference. And sometimes making a difference doesn't mean that you have to be this massive activist, you know, that is known over the world. Making a difference could be being present with your children. Mm-hmm. It's actually raising better humans or improving yourself in order for them to develop healthier mechanisms. For me, I recognize also my mother and my grandmother, they were all also thinking about how big or small they were. And I decided this cycle will end with me. And it also changed the way I look at my relationship. My husband, bless him, is a wonderful man, and he really change his ways as well, because I challenged him a lot and I said, well, when this happens, I don't feel valued, you know, and it was really hard on him. But it was part of my recovery to really say, I'm not going to allow this anymore. I'm going to set the boundaries that work for me. I'm not going to be this yes person all the time. I'm not going to please people if it's at the detriment of my own health and behaviors. Because that's also something that we see a lot with women. They take care of everybody else and they put themselves last all the time. And unfortunately, you know, this is not a good thing. This is something that actually brings more issues for other generations or people in the family or work colleagues. You know, if you have someone like that in the office, it could be very difficult to actually take the time you need for yourself when you need it. So this was also something that I feel strongly about.
On the note of health at every size, which you touched upon, and in the past you've discussed on Goodness the importance of changing your social media feed to include more body diversity, I think a big part of recovery or of coming to a place where you're ready to begin your recovery process is looking into the concept of body diversity. I know that just a couple of years ago, I thought that everyone's natural body type is thin. And if you're not thin, then there's something wrong. Either you're sick or you need to lose weight or something's gone wrong. But in fact, what I've learned is that just as there are short and tall people and blonde and brunettes, there are people who have bigger thighs, smaller bums, larger shoulders. It's all part of the diversity that is on this earth.
Humans are diverse. It's the essence of humanity is that and if you go to the beach, you will see so many different body types, right? You could have all body types, all hair types, I mean, everything. And I agree with you. For me also, it was a big first step. And I think this is something that people will get a lot of reassurance from as well as they recover. Big fear is obviously weight gain for people that are stuck in restrictive ways. And it could be weight gain at any size again. It could be that you are really lean and you feel like you're going to get bigger, or that you felt like you had lost a lot of weight and why you would not go back to that. And this is really something I work with a lot. We just look at all those beliefs, all those fears that people have around food and their bodies, And it's not just about accepting that there is body diversity, it's also embody more. So actually being in your body, as I mentioned before, we spend so much time just not feeling and not being inside of our body, not being mindful of where we are, not even being in the moment. We're always kind of planning ahead or looking at the past. And to me, this is also why mindfulness really helps with dealing with anxiety, for example, and reconnecting you to the present moment, being able to enjoy that your body is here, it's supporting you, it's doing all those things, regardless of how it looks. And I agree with you. I think this idea that you can only get success and all of that through thinness is like the biggest scam. Mm-hmm. It's not true. Yeah. You can get all the things at the weight that you're at. And if you are single, for example, a lot of women will say, but nobody will come to me if I don't look a certain way. But would you want to date a guy that actually only looks at you because you're thin? This is not the real deal. So it's a tough work and it's a long-term work. And I sincerely believe that I am still also on my own path and I learn things as I go along still. But it's totally feasible and you can recover no matter how long you've been doing it. And you can actually work on better self-acceptance. It just takes practice. You just have to kind of work on it. And every time you have those thoughts, kind of question them, sometimes, you know, moving them on the other side and saying, if I think this way, I'm just going to rewire my brain in another way.
So challenge your thoughts.
Challenge your thoughts, kind of putting in new beliefs, working with affirmations, if that helps you, working with mindfulness, seeing a therapist. If you have, for me, I mean, a lot of the deep-seated childhood trauma, I need to deal with a therapist. This is not what coaching can do to you. But all of that, step by step, can get you to a better place, a place where actually you don't even think about how you look. You just live your life, and if you need to put a bikini on at some point, you're like, hey, I'll just put on the bikini and have fun on the beach, and nobody will care.
I'll actually share two exercises that I was instructed to do and that I found to be very helpful in tackling the beliefs that I had. One had to do with the notion or the belief that thinner is more attractive. And the other one had to do with the belief that everyone else was thin. So the everyone else was thin belief, the way that one of the exercises that is recommended to tackle that is to basically go somewhere crowded, whether it's an airport or a mall. I did it in Dubai Mall, so I looked like a little bit of a creep because I was sitting on the side with a pen and paper watching people walk by.
I can imagine you.
And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to look at every third person, whether they are in a leaner body or a bigger body or a medium body even or whatever it is. And what you will find is that there's actually so much diversity and your brain has been trained to only notice the bodies that you find appealing or that you find adhere to your own preconceived notion of what beauty is. So your mind will only notice the girl with the really long legs or the really trim body or the great physique. But if you take a pen and paper and you diligently write down every third body type that you see, you will realize that you're just not noticing everything that's out there.
Such a great exercise.
So that was the first exercise. Oh, have you done that?
For me, it's the beach thing. Yeah. It's like when you see people in their bikinis or whatever, and you're like, yeah, there is really so many different body types.
And the other exercise, which was, I was asked to write a list of, I think five is always a good number, five women that I found attractive and what I found attractive about them. And what I realized is that it was never, I find these five women attractive because all five of them have a thin body. You realize that attractiveness is actually a combination of factors. It's intellect, it's presence, it's energy, it's the way that they move, it's the way that they talk. So it's so much more than just the body weight.
Absolutely. And again, this is just the narratives that we get, you know. How can we blame you for thinking that way? This is what we hear all the time. But this is our duty. And I think goodness is doing an amazing work
Thank
on
you.
That to actually share to people, this is not real, guys. Let's wake up. Let's see that you can live your best life at whatever size. And even if you are plus size and your body is not this perfect hourglass shape, you can still be a successful yoga teacher, or, you know, someone who is a model, or this is really important. Yeah. And my big motivation in this is not so much myself or people of my age, it's the next generation.
Yeah. And your children.
We definitely need to speak to them in a different way that all mothers were speaking to them. And it starts with how mothers speak to themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you have a mother who's constantly saying, I'm not going to have that because I don't want to have, you know, oh, I don't want to put on weight, or my tummy is already big, or, oh, I can't wear this, my hips are too wide. I mean, you get immediately, you believe that, yes, okay, thinner is obviously better because this is what mom seeks, right?
Yeah.
So it's important that as mothers we model that we enjoy our bodies. And for me, it could be also body neutrality, because you can't go from body hate to body love, right?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A big, big change. But for me, I definitely channel the body neutral stance, where I'm like, my body does all these great things for me. I'm never saying like, oh, I love my body today, I look so good. If you do say it, because it shows, actually there's research showing that kids get benefits from that, from their parents seeing themselves enjoying being in their body. But if you don't feel it, like, kids will also feel that it's wrong and that it's fake what you're doing.
Yeah.
So just recognizing that you have a body and it functions and it lets you play with them or have fun at the beach or travel or bring them back from school or walking with them. This is enough, you know.
But that's also called body acceptance, right? Body neutrality.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different terms, ways to look at it.
All right, so one last question for you, Florence. What is the one piece of advice that you would like to leave our listeners with?
My one piece of advice, I think it would really be about, the first step for me would be to try to avoid commenting on bodies so much. This is really one of the first steps that we start with. And on the back of that is the same that we discussed with body diversity, is getting rid of their scale. I practice from a health at every size perspective. I do not ask people what they weigh when they work with me. I ask what their behaviors are. And what we see is that no matter what your weight is, you can get healthy without attaching any value to what the scale tells you. And I see a lot of women suffering so much from weighing themselves. So avoiding commenting on other bodies or your body and ditching your scale is a great first step to actually liberating yourself from a lot of body anxiety. I'm glad that Goodness can be a platform for people to reach out, to figure out what's going on, that they can read, that they can find other practitioners. MIDA is definitely also a great platform in the Middle East if you feel like you might have an eating disorder. But do not be scared. There's a lot of compassion and there's a lot of support out there.
And can you share with our listeners your Instagram handle, please?
Yes, so it's Beyond Body Image also, but it's written in a funny way because the real one was already taken. It's BYOND.BodyImage. This is for Instagram and Facebook.
And Florence has a great weekly newsletter that goes out every Thursday where she shares resources and information, as well as some sort of anecdotes from her experience. So make sure that you register as well.
It's in English and French also.
Okay, great.
Yes, if people want to get the newsletter in French, if this is their language, they can.
Okay. Thank you so much, Florence. It was great having you on the
Thank
podcast.
Thank you for
today.
Having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening today. If you're not familiar with Goodness, head to www.goodness.me to access the online platform and articles, and follow us at Goodness on Instagram. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and share it, and we'll see you next week.